adaptation options that which we think are in the bag and feasible now actually decrease in their effectiveness as climate change. So the very time we actually need them to be operating, they're likely to become less and less effective.
That's Professor Mark Houghton, who is the keynote speaker at the Australian National University's Climate Update from Monday, February 5. Professor Houghton was speaking to a series of slides, but even though this is only audio, I believe his presentation still makes complete sense. Yes, welcome. This is the latest episode of Climate Conversations. Great to have you on board. I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to elders, past, present and emerging. I should note that there was Q&A with this webinar, but I only recorded the presentation by Professor Houghton. Professor Houghton is the Director of the Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions at the Australian National University, the ANU. He was the keynote speaker at the Climate Update for 2024. He was introduced by Professor Frank Jotso, who is the Head of Energy in the same department.
We now move into the program proper for the Climate Update. And the overview session on climate change is by Professor Mark Houghton, of course, the director of the ANU Institute for Climate, Energy and Disaster Solutions. And now, Mark is not just a key person in this field at ANU, he's also an honorary professor at Melbourne University, vice chair of a working group of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's the chair of the ACT Climate Change Council and a fellow of the Australian Academy of Technology and Engineering. Now, Mark, if you don't know, helped develop both the national and international greenhouse gas inventories that are in many ways fundamental part of the Paris Agreement and has assessed sustainable ways to reduce emissions, among many other things in his very wide research portfolio. He's worked on the science, climate variability and change, climate impacts on critical systems such as agriculture, and is a pioneer on how we can take effective action to adapt to climatic changes. Now, Mark has been a major contributor to the IPCC since 1991, and he's had roles in the second, third, fifth, sixth, and now seventh assessment report. Please welcome Mark Houghton.
Thanks very much, Frank, for that introduction, and thanks very much, Mary, for your welcome, and also for those reflections in relation to your interests in climate change, both the opportunities and the threats that it presents. And also thank very much, Genevieve, because climate change is all about making wiser choices for a better future, and that's what this session is about today. So what I'm going to do in the short time that I have, if I can get this to move, is cover in a somewhat eclectic way a series of information which is relevant to what happened particularly last year in relation to climate change. And so the core sort of message, in a sense, is in the title. So we're seeing, you know, overwhelming climate change in some respects and very hobbled responses, both nationally and internationally. And so whilst Renee sorts this out, there's a huge amount of information that fits in here that I could cover. And so it is a very limited take on what's available. Now, one of the key things that I put up every year at this climate update is a graph of carbon dioxide emissions across the globe. So if we look at this graph, comes from the Global Carbon Project. Pep Cannadel and colleagues put this together and many other sources of information for decision-making. Now, what we can see once again in this last year was those emissions were at record levels. We have not yet gone down in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, so we haven't started that decline that is necessary to put a lid on climate change. And so the first message is we're not on track to meet our stated goals in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. As a result of those emissions, we're seeing record levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So it almost peaked out at 425 parts per million last year, and pre-industrial levels were 280 parts per million or thereabouts. And when we look at the long-term record, there was a fairly recent paper that looked at the very long-term records, and we probably haven't exceeded this carbon dioxide concentration for 14 million years. So that's what humans are doing to our atmosphere. Associated with this record levels of methane emissions, nitrous oxide emissions, and various others, leading to record concentrations in the atmosphere of these key greenhouse gases, and all of them contribute to driving climate change. When we look at the amount of time we have available to take action here and to keep temperatures down to 1.5, a very recent paper sort of did those analysis, what we call a carbon budget, which I've talked about before at these events, and we really only have about 6 years left at current rates of emissions before we've effectively done our dough on keeping temperatures down to 1.5 degrees. So we're really not on top of this topic at all in terms of global responses. Now, understandably, put greenhouse gases in the atmosphere will warm the Earth. This is the most recent graph of this annual temperature increases across the globe, about 1.45 degrees above pre-industrial. And you can see that there's a strong curvilinear sort of element to that curve. So it's not just climate change is going up, but it's going up faster and faster over time. So it's accelerating. When we look at the records here, 1.45 degrees is a very, very significant step up from any previous temperature, and I'll show you what that looks like in a second. Importantly, last year, for the first time, is that global temperatures were assessed as exceeding 2 degrees on two separate occasions in November last year. That's information from the Copernicus group in the European area. Now, what this looks like on a month-by-month basis, I think is really telling. So this graph, which comes from that group, shows month by month across each year. So each horizontal sort of wiggly line is a different year. They're color-coded, so the years associated, say, with the Second World War are blue. They go to red colors as we approach the present. And we can see that since June of this year, we were amazingly far out of any previous temperature. So it wasn't just that we were record-breaking, but this was a massive, massive break in the records. And you can see that graphically here, the gap between 2023 and any previous year. And climate science over in the US, when he looked at this, he said, this is gobsmackingly bananas, was his description of it, very scientific description of what is a really quite terrifying graph. And the problem is that this gap between any previous year's record and the current record has actually extended into January. So it wasn't just 2023, it continues. And so we've seen essentially that line go horizontal. We don't know at this point whether this is an aberration or a step change, or whether this is in fact some beginning of a new phase of climate change. So just on the weekend, there was a paper that was released on this, which looked at the likelihood of getting this type of temperature and splitting it up into things like what's due to climate change, what's due to internal climate variability, such as El Niño, La Niña, what's due to the Tonga volcano, and what's due to the big reduction in shipping pollution that occurred a couple of years ago. And the answer they came out with is you can't explain this simply by the climate change and variability signals alone. There are other things going on which we don't fully understand. And the particularities of that are the shipping was, ships often ran on very dirty fuel, and so it produced lots of sulfate pollution. That sulfate pollution caused lots of health problems and environmental problems, but at the same time, it kept the atmosphere cooler. It kept the Earth's surface cooler because these sulfates reflect sunlight. Now, when you clean up one problem, what has possibly happened is we reveal another problem, which is starting to reveal that previously disguised temperature warming. So that's one possible explanation. The other is the Tonga volcano. Because it was a subsurface undersea volcano, it put a huge amount of water vapor into the upper atmosphere, and that takes a long time to settle out of the atmosphere. And that water vapor could be influencing temperature. But previous assessments of the influence of these factors, again, don't add up to what we're actually observing. So there's some real important need for sort of additional research to understand what's going on in our systems. Now, to display what that looks like on a spatial basis, so we've gone on a temporal basis, moving into a spatial basis. This is a map from NASA over in the US, and what that shows is temperature anomalies for last year, and you can see that effectively every part of the world was significantly warmer than the long-term average. And this is a relatively recent baseline, 1951 to 80. And importantly, you can see that there's big parts of the Northern Hemisphere which are extraordinarily hot, including places that were like 5 degrees warmer than the long-term average, but also West Antarctic Peninsula, and that's accelerating the warming that we're seeing. And of course, that warming then generates sea level rise. And that warming also has biological impacts, and that level of warming has so raised concern amongst the coral reef conservation community that their previous heat warming system had to be upgraded to get 3 new levels of warming, just in the same way as our fire system warnings had to actually start to increase the number of warnings, and we've got that catastrophic level now that we didn't have previously. So what we're seeing already is so significant that it's actually causing a fundamental rethink of the classifications. So we're having to classify things in ways which we never expected to have to do in the past. Now, if we actually look at what's likely to happen over the next decade or two, obviously one of the key thresholds is the 1.5 degrees that the Pacific Islands nations inserted into the Paris Agreement. And as a fundamental threshold that we're looking to maintain and stay within. So this is, again, a graph from the Copernicus Institute looking at temperatures. There's a linear regression line through that. You track out where that regression line crosses over the 1.5 degree sort of mark. And the answer is at current rates of change, at linear rates of change, we're likely to exceed 1.5 degrees in 2033, so 10 years from now. If we actually do something which matches a little more closely the data and just do a curvilinear line through that, we actually see that we're probably going to exceed 1.5 degrees by 2028, a handful of years away, a literal handful of years away. And at the pace of change, the first slide I showed you, where we still have not started to turn the curve and start reducing our emissions, a handful of years seems like a really, really big challenge to start to actually address this in a significant way. Now, as a result of that warming, we see lots and lots of impacts, amongst others, extraordinary melting of the Greenland ice sheet. And so we're seeing breakdown happening in ways we simply did not predict just a handful of years ago. And that's generated huge other effects such as sea level rise, which I'll show you in a second. If we look at the Southern Hemisphere, the sea ice around Antarctica was the minimum on the lowest on record, both for the maximum and minimum extents, the summer and winter extents. And there's assessments now that we may well have entered into a new era of sea ice. That we're unlikely to go back to previous sea ice extents because of the inherent feedbacks in that system. And if you look at sea level rise, obviously, if you've got lots of melting ice, glaciers and ice sheets, et cetera, the sea level obviously tends to go up. This is a relatively recent record, but last year it went up around 10 millimetres. Over the last couple of decades, it tends to have gone up roughly about 4.5 millimetres per year. If we look back at last century, it went up about 1.8 millimetres per year. So we're seeing essentially like, you know, potentially up to a 5-fold increase in the rates of sea level rise per year. That uptick, we have had significant increases in sea level rise in the past due to various factors, but it is really worrying the linkage of this to that high temperatures, which I showed you before. We also had huge wildfires in Canada, but obviously not restricted to Canada. And you can see that the scale of these wildfires that they experience are similar in nature to what we experienced in our Black Summer. So about 18 million hectares burnt in Canada. And that is the sort of largest on record. And that generated huge amounts of pollution, including pollution, air pollution in New York City. And you can see the Empire State Building here in this graph, very, very reminiscent of what Canberra and other Australian cities experienced in the Black Summer. All of a sudden, these issues come home to people who live far away from those fires. And it wasn't just in Canada, but we saw massive fires in Hawaii, in Chile, South America, and Europe and others, leading to significant loss of life. Chile, for example, is just experiencing wildfires with the highest ever number of deaths. That's happening almost as we speak. We're seeing extreme rainfall propagate continually across the globe, with floods happening regularly in places that were infrequent in the past, with an absolutely massive event in Libya associated with what's now called a Medicane, a sort of a Mediterranean cyclone, essentially flooding Derna. That's the picture down the bottom, a city in Libya, and possibly killing up to 11,000 people in one hit. This is extraordinary. And we saw Tropical Cyclone Freddy earlier in around this time last year. And this tropical cyclone just kept on going and going as it went from the Australian part of the Indian Ocean right across to Africa and then back up into the Indian Ocean. And it was the longest lived, the most accumulated energy, and the most serially, you know, multiple sort of rapid intensification cyclone on record. This is a picture of the future. It is quite scary. What's happening on this one? I don't know why it's not working anymore. And then moving a little bit more locally, we see this study, which has come from some colleagues here in Australia, looking at rates of domestic and non-domestic violence, both inside and outside. And without going into huge amounts of detail, pretty much all of it is linked to temperature. So as the temperature goes up, violence goes up. The way in which it happens depends on the context, whether you're inside or outside, and it's domestic or otherwise. Now, really important to note that particular domestic violence is very gendered. This differentially impacts on males and females. And so when we're starting to think about these things, we need to think about those complexities and those interactions that occur. Where are we up to, Alex? When we're starting to look at those sort of issues, we see this accumulation of information, which is that the climate is changing, and it's actually changing far faster than we anticipated even just a handful of years ago. So next two. And now I want to move in the next part of the talk to sort of three topics. One is the IPCC, next is COP28, and lastly, a little bit on policy action in Australia. The first of these is the IPCC reports. And so we finished the last cycle of the IPCC last year. That's the sixth assessment cycle. We're now into the seventh assessment cycle. What's pictured here are all of the reports from this, starting from the special report for 1.5 degrees through to the synthesis report. And I've actually put up the topic that these IPCC reports are dangerous. And amongst other things, they're dangerous because the cumulative weight of those is 27 kilos. And that starts to enter into the space where this is a dangerous item to pick up. And you actually can't pick this up in many jurisdictions unless you have mechanical help or you have someone else to help you move this thing. These are incredibly massive reports. Natalie totaled up the number of pages for this. And so there's 1,880 pages of in these reports. There's a huge amount of information, many tens of thousands of references, hundreds of thousands of comments to make these reports more relevant and more effective. And if you haven't looked at something on climate change, grab hold of the summary for policymakers of the synthesis report, because it's a telling compilation of what we know about climate change. And Frank Yotso, sitting here, was a lead author of that synthesis report, has been very active in the IPCC as well. Now, just a few key messages coming from the synthesis report. So what we have here is a graph of potential trajectories of greenhouse gas emissions going out to the future. The top sort of orangey plume is what we can expect with existing policy settings. If we want to keep to 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees, we have to go onto the green, the blue trajectories that angle downwards, heading down towards zero, and in some cases below zero in the case of carbon dioxide and 1.5 degrees. We can't achieve 1.5 degrees without going below zero. And when we look at that, we've got a real challenge here, because the gap between where we're going, current policies, and where we need to go, which is the 1.5 degree and 2 degree trajectories, is massive. And we haven't got in place the policies and technology that's going to take us there at the moment. And if we're going to achieve 1.5 degrees, we have to have really, really significant reductions of greenhouse gas emissions in the very near future. We can't wait till 2050. It has to happen right now. And in fact, if we don't start on the downward trend by 2025, the best estimate that is too late to achieve 1.5 degrees. It's next year. So we have not got time to waste here. If we want to stick to 2 degrees, it's a more lenient sort of set of reductions, but still those sorts of emission reductions, such as 27% by 2030, still exceed those of many companies, many organizations like universities, and many governments across the world. So we're significantly undershooting in terms of emission reduction. We're going to significantly overshoot in terms of temperature as the best estimate. Now, Frank's talked about this, but I think it's really important to cover, is that when we look at the sets of options available to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, there's a huge number of these. There is no shortage of things that we can do. And a big slab of these can reduce greenhouse gas emissions using existing technologies. And the assessment from the IPCC is for less than $100 US a tonne of carbon dioxide, we can actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 50% compared with 2019 levels by 2030. And around half of that portfolio of options are less than $20 US a tonne. And for quite a few of them, you actually make money. So for example, from renewables. So there's really good reason to think that if we got serious about this, we could make a big dent in our greenhouse gas emissions, but we're not doing that. And if we design these well, they can not only reduce greenhouse emissions, but they can also help us adapt to future climate change, and they can also help us achieve sustainable development goals. When we look at some of the other good news stories coming out of the synthesis report, is that assessing the cost and the adoption of different renewable technologies, we see that cost keeps on coming down and down and down, and the adoption keeps on going up and up and up. And that's the same whether we're looking at small-scale solar, large-scale solar, onshore wind, offshore wind, and in terms of batteries. So there's good reason to think that these relationships of cost and adoption are going to continue, and that can be helped by governments, by active government policies. And we do have quite a bit of that policy setting here in Australia. When we look at the adaptation part of the picture, that's the responding to climate change, the IPCC documented a huge amount of options that are available and known in terms of how to adapt to climate change. And I've just listed a few here. So dealing more effectively in planning, don't put people in floodplains, for example. Dealing more in terms of infrastructure, so build climate-friendly futures, so buildings that are appropriate to our future climate, not just to the present climate. We have preparedness and response capacity and building capacity right across places like Australia and the Pacific. And the list goes on. We can integrate climate change responses to generate co-benefits. So having climate action that also generates conservation outcomes, for example. So we can do these. We know a lot about how to do it. Again, we're just not doing it. Really importantly, the IPCC identified that political commitment was actually a really important part of adaptation. So having clear signals from governments, bipartisan agreement or tripartisan agreement, that we want to deal with climate change and we're going to deal with this in a consistent way, regardless of who's in government, is a really important part of the picture, just as is education. So bringing the level of climate knowledge up of the average person so they don't confuse climate change with the hole in the ozone layer, for example. So there's a lot that we can do, and we know a lot about how to do it. Unfortunately, not all sectors have easy answers. And one of those is the finance sector and the insurance sector. And we're seeing increasingly stress in our insurance system, including through people speculating that climate change may actually bust the insurance system. And that would throw a massive, massive spanner in the works for our economies here and elsewhere. We also see the assessment in terms of the IPCC in terms of adaptation performance. And so what the IPCC assesses essentially is on this slide is that there are significant gaps between where we are in terms of our adaptation responses and where rationally we should be. And unfortunately, those gaps are growing, they're not shrinking, and they're affecting the poorest people most, the people often with least capacity to deal with climate change. We see that most of the adaptation responses that we can record and analyze, they're very fragmented, they're very incremental, so they're not transformational in their nature. They're often very sector specific and not transferable, and they're often unequally distributed. So they're distributed differentially across different groups in the society or across different locations.
You're listening to Professor Mark Howden, who gave the keynote address at Australian National University's Climate Update for 2024, and you're with Climate Conversations.
We see that adaptation options, which we think are in the bag and feasible now, actually decrease in their effectiveness as climate change. So the very time we actually need them to be operating, they're likely to become less and less effective. So that means we have to be generating more and new adaptation options which are appropriate to the circumstance. A challenge when governments are still just struggling with adapting to the changes that we're seeing concurrently. And there's lots and lots of barriers to adaptation, including finance ones, but oftentimes we actually know how to overcome those barriers. We know how to overcome some of the social and psychological inequity issues associated with different adaptation options. But again, we're just not doing that. And we see right across the sort of progressive business areas, corporate governance, that climate adaptation is now just seen as good business practice. It's not an option, it's just normal. And many businesses overseas actually have bonuses built into their KPIs for their corporate executives that actually require that performance in terms of climate adaptation and emission reduction. We still haven't seen that here. Now, the last of these items, or maybe the second last, is looking at COP. COP28, Frank was there, I wasn't. So this is my take as an armchair critic of COP. So generally speaking, COP was seen as a success, is that pretty much every group that went there could come home and shout to their constituency, I've had a win. And that generated really differential media sort of titles, for example. You know, one bunch saying, you know, it's the beginning of the end for fossil fuels, and the other saying, actually, fossil fuels won at COP. You know, very, very diverse sort of perspectives. That's why I actually think that most parties there would actually go and wave the flag. So, for example, we had a global stocktake of progress. Big tick. We said we're going to do that. Loss and damage fund became operational. Great. Food security and agriculture recognized. Absolutely good. Independence of climate and environment. No brainer. Why shouldn't we do that? Adaptation goals agreed. Something that's been on the burner for since the Paris Agreement, but not achieved until now. And a whole stack of other aspirational goals, tripling of renewable energy capacity, accelerating reduction in non-CO2 gases, accelerating reduction in non-energy systems, and phasing out fossil fuel subsidies, et cetera, et cetera. All sounds great, except big question marks about this. So when you actually start to delve into this, it's just not as rosy as it looks from the surface. So for example, the global stocktake, major conclusion, we're not taking action fast enough. Bit of a no-brainer, but that's the thing. So we're failing, is the message from the global stocktake. Loss and damage fund operational. Yep, great. But a lot of the mechanisms behind that are incomplete. So not very clear about how to get the money and how to partition it out. And they gathered together about $800 million, which is about 0.2% of what is assessed to be needed for the loss and damage fund. you make your own mind up whether that was a success or not. Food security and agriculture, similarly, big statement, the Emirates Declaration, everyone's going to put it in their national action plans, but a tiny, tiny fraction of the support that's needed to actually make that operational. Independence of environment and climate strategies, there was actually a reasonable amount of money generated on that, about $1.7 billion, but essentially it's just put on the back burner, kick the can down the road for the next meeting as to how to deal with this. Adaptation of goals agreed. So we've got seven big adaptation goals, which sort of say build capacity and, you know, get more information. They're not very helpful when it comes to on-ground action. And that adaptation fund, again, the money that was put together for that at this meeting was 0.1, or in fact less than 0.1% of the assessed need. Again, it sounds great, but when you start to delve, it's not that great at all. And there's, you know, I could go on with that story. But just to give you an example of if you start to dissect this, what does this look like? So this is one of the key statements coming out of the COP28. It's the transition away from fossil fuel statement, hugely argued by negotiating governments. And this is what was landed. So what it says is it calls on parties to transition away from fossil fuels and energy systems in a just, orderly and equitable manner. Who can argue with that? Accelerating action is critical decade. Sounds good. So as to achieve net zero by 2050 in keeping with the science. You know, like ticks all the boxes. So let's just dissect this a little bit. Calls on parties. What does that actually mean? So there is this little document which actually shows in negotiator speak the strength of different categories of demand from the parties to the convention. So the strongest one is parties instruct various other parties to act. The next one is request, then urges, then invites, and then recommends, and then encourages, and then right at the bottom, the weakest possible statement is calls on. So when you actually look back at this statement, this is the weakest possible language that the negotiators could agree on. So do you think that's been a real resounding success for those people who want action on climate change? Let's move on. Transitioning away, what does that mean? You know, a 10% reduction, 20% reduction, by when? Transitioning away is completely ambiguous. Energy systems, is that all energy systems or just electricity systems, you know, transport, stationary energy, you know, what does it include? Completely ambiguous. Just and equitable. Like we can see on our TVs every day that someone's just and equitable solution is another person's war crime. This is not easily resolved in the international courts. Accelerating action. What does that mean? Are we accelerating slowly or quickly? You know, what are we actually going to do here? Critical decade. Well, actually, it's the critical year. As I said before, we have to act before 2025. This isn't about the critical decade. This is about effectively tomorrow, the critical year. We'd need to count in months, not in years, in terms of the need for action here. And then net zero by 2050. Well, what the science actually says is that if we aim for 2050, we're too late at current trajectories for both 1.5 and 2 degrees. And if we go to net zero, it's not enough for 1.5 degrees. We have to go below zero. So when it actually says in keeping with the science, it's not. So what do you do with a statement like this? I mean, it's the best they could do, probably at the negotiating tables, but it's highly ambiguous and it leaves incredible space for argument for the future and incredible wriggle room. So when we start to look at these sorts of statements, and you could go through almost every paragraph of COP28 and take it apart in the same sort of way, there's not a huge amount of good news there for people who want climate action. Now, the last slide is on policy and action here in Australia. And so it's a mixed bag. So when we look at Australia's greenhouse gas emissions, if we take out the land use change, which is clearing is a one-off thing, so you can't stop clearing twice. And so when we take that out, is what we actually see is from 2005 to the current time, our emissions have reduced by 1.3%. To all intents and purposes, that's flatlining. And in fact, they went up last year, so between 2022 and 2023. So we're not at a national scale doing what is needed in terms of reducing our emissions. If we look at aspirational targets, so for example, Queensland just announced their new emission reduction targets, 75% reduction by 2035. That's ambitious, it's great, it's what's needed. And then net zero by 2050, you know, slight argument about that, but that's pretty good. And we see Queensland starting to join most of the other states and territories in Australia with that goal. And so that's a really good thing. So that's a tick instead of a cross. We see renewables are driving incredible change and accelerating their impact on Australia. And so we see some really interesting headlines coming up. So, you know, renewables halving energy price, you know, last quarter versus the quarter before. That at a global scale, nuclear and coal, et cetera, are going backwards. Renewables are taking up the slack. And some really interesting research that shows that economies which are based and heavily based on renewables actually recover faster from disruption than those which are based on fossil fuels. So we see good reason that renewables are a very positive thing, and Australia really is at the forefront, and particularly mums and dads investors who put solar on their roofs are generating huge amounts of power to put into our electricity system. And Frank could tell you a lot more about that than I could. We see Commonwealth and other policies such as the Net Zero Economic Authority and the new vehicle emission standards, which just got announced open for consultation just on the weekend. These are really positive things. They can help the transition. They can help drive down greenhouse gas emissions, save money for consumers by having more efficient cars. You use less petrol, you save money, particularly as petrol prices go up. So these are really positive policies, and we need to appreciate them and recognise them and support them, because it's not all bad. We need to recognise that there is good action happening. But at the same time, as we got the good policies, we're also seeing opening of new coal and gas facilities here in Australia. And the Australian Institute did an analysis of those new facilities, and their assessment was that could emit around about 4.8 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide by 2030. This is not doing our part of a global solution. We understand all of the economic and other drivers of this, but it is challenging to reconcile these two parts of the equation. We also see in Australia a lot more legal cases, including cases about greenwashing brought by some of the regulators. And we also see green hushing. So a South Pole, it's a company, did a survey which actually found that more than a quarter of Australian companies were cutting back on their climate comms because they were seeing this as a potential vulnerability. Being too open about climate activity leads to potential litigation or other cases against them. And we also see some positive things there. So for example, we see the legislation, which is open to assessment by the corporate world, amongst others, for mandatory disclosure of climate action. And at the moment, the anticipation is that that's going to be released in July and put in place. And that will be really positive, because it actually enables people to make decisions much more effectively about things that they purchase, for example, or where they're going to invest their money. So we need more disclosure. We need that information. We need transparency. And the last point that I've put up here is that one of the bits of information that came out just over the last month or so was, over the last year, our population increased by 624,000 people, you know, almost 2/3 of a million people. You can't have that type of immigration without making the emission reduction job harder here in Australia, let alone all of the issues about, rental prices and traffic in cities, et cetera. There is a greenhouse gas consequence of increased population in Australia, just like there is a greenhouse gas consequence of extreme events. So if you think back to extreme events such as flooding in Lismore, one of the pictures that sticks in my mind is that the post-event scene, there's mounds and mounds of junk. You know, everyone's throwing out their sofas and throwing out their washing machines and throwing out this and that, mud-encrusted clothes, et cetera. And every one of those things has to be replaced, and every one of those replacements has a greenhouse gas footprint. And so that winds up climate change. So the more extreme events you have, the more of that happens, the more greenhouse gases you produce and the more extremes you get. We need to start thinking about how to break these feedbacks, break the cycle. Now, that's where I'm going to finish my talk, but it's really important to leave on a positive note, and that's actually where the next session takes up the slack. Because when we see this, is that what the assessments of people taking action is, people take action most when they actually see that there's both a concern, that's the talk that I've just given, but also where there's hope. And as Greta Thunberg said, hope comes from action. And so being able to go from anxiety to action is the topic of the next session, because we need to be able to be informed, but motivated, but committed to action in terms of climate change, because as I've shown you, there is no time to waste. Thank you.
You'll find a link for the ANU Climate Update 2024 in the show notes. And although the recording of the event is not there yet, I'm sure if you check back with ANU, it will be there within a week or so. Well, that's the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's great to have you along. Now, I'd love you to follow this podcast, because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. And beyond that, I'd love you to share this with your friends. Put it on your networks. Let people know what's going on with the climate crisis. We need everybody on board. As it was once said, to change everything, we need everyone. Also, if you'd like to be a guest on this show, and I'd like to hear your voice, give me a call. Send me an email to r.mclean7@icloud.com. Let me know you want to be a guest, and I'll contact you somehow. Beyond all that, I want to know how you feel about this podcast. Please let me know, good or bad, don't hold back, let me know, and use that same email address. Now, until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. Everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Now you take care and stay safe.